Welcome to this week's episode of Electric Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined by Seth Ventura via Vermont. How are you, Seth?
I'm good, Fred.
Awesome. All right, so a little bit slower this week in terms of EV news, of course, because of the holiday week. But still a few cool things to talk about. First of all, we're going to start with a little update on the continuing cold weather issues that we've been talking about with the Model 3. Tesla has been saying that he's going to address those things. Elon Musk particularly said that Tesla is going to introduce some new cold weather convenience features in the coming weeks, not directly related to our issue. At first, he was talking about the ability to start the seat warming from the application, which is nice, though I don't think that's that big of a deal. If you think on pre-heating, you normally like think a lot about the cabin climate before the seats. Though I think some people, the goal of some people, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I think some people prefer the seat heating because it consumes less energy than doing the cabin, the low cabin climate heating. Is that a thing? Oh, I cannot hear you for some reason.
Yeah, it's not just the seat. It's also the steering wheel. Apparently, if you just turn on the seat and the steering wheel, that's kind of a lot less energy, electricity to use than heating up the whole, you know, the air in the whole car. So if you want to be very economical about your heating, just the seat and the steering wheel should do you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Though, if when it comes to Model 3, if the car is outside, you're still better off with the cabin heating just to try to get your windows to unfreeze a little bit and maybe the mechanism inside the doors too, which brings us to when Elon tweeted that, I suggested the thing that a bunch of people suggested on our last article about the Model 3's windows freezing and the door handle freezing. And a lot of people suggested that if there was a way from the app to direct the airflow on the windows, they could warm up faster and not be stuck. I tweeted that to Elon and he said it was a good idea. So hopefully that's implemented as soon as possible.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, for sure. And Tesla ended up releasing quickly a few days later, actually just last night, another software update for the Model 3 addressing some of those cold weather issues. Specifically when, in the release note themselves, they wrote the window position and charge connector locking behaviors have been optimized for cold weather. So that wasn't very clear, but I tested it out myself last night. And what it appears to do is that, so as we already explained, since the Model 3 has frameless windows, the window has to come down a little bit in order to clear the trim around the car, around the door entry, in order for you to open the door. Now, since the issue was that if the door was frozen shut, the window wouldn't come out. So if you needed to open the door, you would actually have to scratch on the trim itself. Same thing if you close it, you wouldn't be able to close it fully. My understanding based on that update, now when it does come down, it never goes back up completely. So right now, if I go look at my Model 3, the windows are down just a little bit, enough to clear the trim, but not down enough that it doesn't clear the seal around the door, the door seal. So it's not like the snow could get inside or anything like that. So it's not a perfect solution, but it does work. I mean, even if the door is frozen, even the mechanism that rolled down the window is frozen, I can still open the door. So I guess it is a solution, just not enough. Yeah, I guess
that's the bottom line. Like, you just want to get in.
Yeah.
And then you heat up the car and everything. It's fine.
Yeah. And when I did it the first last night, there was a big issue with it where even though the window did come down, and that was after like 20 minutes or so of preheating the car, it seems like the way it went down, it wasn't at the same level that it normally does when you open and close the door. So it would actually scratch on the trim of the door, which is not good at all. But then this morning when I tried again, and this time I couldn't actually preheat the car for some reason. My Model 3 wouldn't wake up. Like for 10, 20 minutes, I was trying to wake up the Model 3 to start the preheating before I can try to open the door. Wouldn't wake up. So I actually had to do some things to try it. So I just walked up the car. And even though my Model 3 wouldn't wake up, it's still unlocked. So I could still press on the door handle and unlock the door. And when I did that, the window was still down, scratch on it. But then I closed it again, and then it went back up and reset. So when I opened it again, this time it went back down just enough to clear the trim. And then when I closed the door, it didn't go back up. So right now there's still like post-update level that Tesla is making in order to clear the door seal. A bunch of people are complaining, of course, about the update, saying that it's not a perfect solution. And of course, it certainly is not. I mean, a stronger mechanism would be the best solution, but that's not something you can do over the air update. But so, for the people that are complaining that it affects the seal of the door, I don't think it does really, because the closer you look at it, the door seems pretty isolated, even with the window not completely sealed up. It's not perfect, but it looks pretty good. I'm not mad at it. As for the charge port, Tesla, because I couldn't see a difference with the charge port, even though what they said with the release notes. But we reached out to Tesla, and they said that the charge port will remain unlatched to allow a charge cable to be inserted, even in the event of the latch is frozen. So that's in response to a bunch of people complaining about not being able to plug their Model 3 because the latch would just froze. I'm sorry. But now there apparently is a certain temperature where the charge port will just not latch at all. So you'll be able to open and close it regardless, apparently. I'm not, I asked like what temperature exactly, but they couldn't say. So I'm not sure. It was minus 11 Celsius here, and I could hear it latch. So I kind of really don't know what's going to be the minimum for that, because like minus 11, it's apparently it starts to be where some people were having issue. I never had the issues with my my charge port, but the way I park my car outside at my home, it's sort of protected from the wind. So I don't know if that had an impact on it versus the other side, but that's also the same size. Well, of course, the charge port the same side as the driver's door, and my driver's door had issues, so I don't know.
That's interesting. I haven't had actually. I mean, we garage ours, obviously, so it's not we're in a different realm. But I haven't had that many cold weather issues with the Model 3, besides the much lower range, which I think a lot of people have experienced. Some people are getting about 30 to 40% less range, which is a pretty big jump. I don't know. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's an issue here exactly, if it's just that a lot of people are just surprised by it. I think that's maybe something that hasn't been very well communicated about electric vehicles, the kind of effect that the temperature is going to have on your efficiency. And I'm hearing right now a lot. I'm getting a lot of messages and email from people that are really surprised by how much less they get with the cold temperature. Like some people are even thinking like, oh, do you think that their car has a problem? It's not like it's not normal. I wouldn't go that far so far. Like when I've seen like some people like getting like 200 miles of range in cold weather, that could actually be normal depending on how cold are we talking about here.
Some people like to keep their car at like 78 degrees. You know, if that's the case, you're going to lose a lot of range.
Yeah, that and also all you drive has a big impact too. The faster you drive, the more range you're going to drop, that's for sure. I mean, I don't know, like there's some efficiencies to be made if you think you're going to need the range. But for the most part, like for your daily driving, it shouldn't really be an issue, because even if it dropped by that much. Let's say that you charge your car at 90%, you still get it to go like close to 300 miles of range. Let's say you drop now for 30 or 40% of efficiency, you still get some pretty good range for daily driving. So unless you're planning a trip, then if you're planning a trip, then maybe start thinking about driving more efficiently. But for the most part, I don't think we've seen any clear indication that the Model 3 is like less efficient in winter than any other car in terms of the driving performance and the driving efficiency. The issue really seems to be if you're not garaging the car and leaving outside in the cold, there seems to be some issues that we haven't seen before. A lot of people are saying, oh, that's normal for a car. It's not normal for a premium car like that, even with frameless windows. I mean, like I said last time, I had a Model S at the exact same condition last winter, and it has frameless windows and wasn't that big of a deal like this one. So we'll see. Right before that, that's the thing that inspired the tweet to Elon Musk about the directing the airflow to the windows, because just after the podcast last week, Tesla ended up pushing an update for the Model 3. And the Model 3 included a new climate controls for the Model 3 with an updated visualization of it. Like the Model 3, we know, has some cool visualization of a... did that just lose the... for some reason? Sorry, just give me a second.
Get some technical difficulties over there.
Yeah. All right, for some reason I cannot put it back on. Lost the connection or something. All right, anyway...
It's a nice background.
It was back? Oh, okay, the background. All right. yeah. So the Model 3 is a cool climate control visualization where you can actually see the airflow. Tesla improved it so you can see, like, it's more accurate where you see where it's going. And you can also direct it more easy. It's easier to direct it with your finger. You can just drag the airflow to where you want to see it. And you can also, you have a new pinch motion to, split the airflow in two, because you have at first you have two different airflow, one for each side, but you can split those to have, I guess, like four now different airflow. Sorry. And what you could do is concentrate those directly on the windows and have it warms faster, though. You can do it right now by just the suggestion was to doing through the app directly. But what you can do right now is just set it toward the windows and before you leave the car. And then once you preheat the car, it should remain the same settings. So the airflow is going to go directly to the windows. So you can, it's a workaround, though it would be easier to do it directly from the app.
One other thing with the Model 3, do you find that you connect to your Model S quicker from the app than you do your Model 3? My Model 3 usually takes like 30 seconds to a minute to connect.
And yeah,
maybe
for sure.
Maybe settings or something.
It doesn't take 30 seconds for me normally, but the Model S is almost instantaneous for me.
Same with my Model X.
Yeah, and Model 3 will take like 10, 15 seconds or so, which is kind of annoying sometimes. But normally, without like, just to wake up when you want to play with the controls, right? If you just walk up to your car,
right,
it's going to unlock, right?
Yeah. So and you might be right. I think it might be more like 10 seconds. It just feels like 30 seconds.
Yeah, when you open it, you want right away to. We're so used now to just having everything like completely instantaneous. And so when it's not, it feels like a lifetime, really. But
first world problems.
But for sure, there is a difference. I've seen the difference. I think a lot of other people that who have the previous Tesla, like the S or X, I've seen that. Yeah, I don't know why, though. I wouldn't see why it would be an issue.
Maybe it's a power-saving thing to only ping the internet every 10 seconds rather than every 1 second or something.
Yeah, so like for Vampire Drain or so, like it would drain the battery pack less when the car is not
maybe it's less AT&T bill to only have one ping every...
Oh, okay, you mean on a broadband perspective, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that could make sense. Yeah, moving on a Tesla pickup truck, and not just a pickup truck, but the whole Tesla product roadmap, really. Elon had an interesting tweet about that this week, where he tweeted that It tweeted a priority list basically of the upcoming product, and the list go as follows: Model Y, solar roof tiles, pickup, semi, and then roadster. So when Elon tweeted that, I asked him if that's in order. Well, because he said the priority list just like that. Then I asked, like, what's the order really? Like, is it in the right order? He said yes, but in order of resource priority. So it doesn't exactly mean that that's when the vehicle are going to come out or be in production. But, well, I think being production wouldn't make sense, because what's the most resource intensive is bringing the car to production. So, would that make sense, that list, Model Y, sort of roof tiles? Well, solar roof tiles actually is already in production, just in low volume, and they've been promising a ramp up in the early 2019.
What's kind of sticks out there is that we've already seen the semi and the roadster, but we haven't seen the pickup truck, and the pickup truck has apparently a higher priority, although, different production scale, different, a lot of differences there, but it kind of, to me, that sounds like they are going to announce, when they announce on March 15th or whenever, the Model Y, I believe that they are going to also talk about the pickup truck, which I think...
Talk about it or unveil it too?
Unveil it. Maybe not it probably has a similar platform as the Model Y, or they could, they could theoretically make it so. And I think there's the opportunity to sell pickup trucks in the U.S. is huge. So the quicker they get that to market, if they build that on the Model Y platform, basically, chop off, right after the passenger area and just make a flatbed in the back. I don't think it's that.
Yeah, the thing is, though, the Model Y is like a relatively small crossover or something, while the pickup truck is not only supposed to be like a pickup truck size. It's actually a big for a pickup truck that Elon has been promising.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's like it's not even a 150 competitor, like bigger than that. So,
well, the 150 used to be smaller, and I've recently seen the new ones, and they're huge.
Yeah, the Raptor one, with the huge suspension.
Right.
Yeah, so it might be something like that. So I don't know if you can base that on the Model Y, but there could still be some technology developed for the Model Y that could be transferred into the components and stuff. But what's most interesting here, I think, for most people, because we already knew like Model Y is going to be priority. The solar roof tile sounds, I wouldn't have put the solar roof tile all in there, because I feel like in terms of resource priority, they already put a lot of resources in them in Gigafactory 2 for the production and everything. So it's more about like ramping up now the production, which should happen as soon as next year. So first quarter next year. So I don't know. Anyway, I think what was most interesting for most people in there was the pickup truck being in front of the Tesla Semi. So Tesla would, if what Elon is saying is true, would be that Tesla is planning to put more resources toward the pickup truck next year than it does on the Semi. And the concern with that, of course, is that Tesla has already been taking a reservation with deposit for the Tesla Semi. And although normal Tesla customer, Tesla reservation holders are quite used to delays and stuff like that, Tesla Semi reservation holders are industrial customers. So it's not the same thing. I think they're going to they're going to give Tesla less wiggle room in terms of the timing of the delivery. Since it's all about the numbers for them. So I don't know. I think Tesla should keep some priority on the Tesla Semi in terms of deliveries. And so he did say that it doesn't necessarily mean the production ramp. So, because the bulk of the investment would be in the production ramp probably, and Tesla could like start Tesla Semi production very slowly, maybe like just deliver the, because they've been saying 2019, I mean 2019 next year, if So I just cannot see Tesla delivering the pickup truck next year. That's impossible, right? We all agree on that.
I guess. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, if I had to bet, yes, I would say no, there's no way.
I wouldn't put too much hope in that. You're going to be disappointed, I think. Even 2020 sounds impossible because just earlier this year, Elon Musk has been talking about Model Y late 2020. Anyway, we're talking right now. We're speculating. I think the most important thing is what you said. It's unveiling the Tesla pickup truck at the same time as the Model Y in early 2019 so that they can start taking reservation for it and they can show that there's a lot of demand for an all-electric pickup truck. I think that's the most important thing because that's what's going to accelerate the whole thing. Well, I'm saying that now, but I could change my mind as soon as next week. Because next week, we're going to see Rivian unveiling their pickup truck, their all-electric pickup truck. And maybe that alone is going to be enough to sort of kickstart the whole all-electric pickup truck industry in the U.S. Because it's certainly not GM, not Ford, not Chrysler that's going to do that. I think for sure that Tesla could do it with the unveiling of their own pickup truck. But maybe Rivian can do it before them. We'll see. It really depends on how attractive that truck's going to be.
Yeah, and we've seen a couple other, like, Workhorse and, let's see, what's the company that's got that from Hobart, New York?
Yeah, that's more like a Jeep.
But don't they have a pickup?
Like, oh, yeah, they did on the pickup version, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I'm just, the Bollinger. Thing is, in terms of the industry, I think Rivian has more weight than those two companies. Workhorse is has some credibility because they're already delivering trucks. Though, if you look at the truck, it's a no one's gonna buy that. I think the truck. I mean, and I don't want to be mean to them. I'm saying it like for a commercial purpose. I think it makes sense. But you look at the interior; it's very cheap. It's all plastics. Like in terms of consumer product, it's not great. Apparently, they're getting tons of order for commercial fleet. That makes a lot of sense. But as a personal, like owning that as your own truck, I don't think a lot of people are going to be into that. Bollinger looks cool, but in terms of like getting that thing to production, I think they're having a tougher time. They are a much smaller startup. The most attractive thing about Rivian is that we know they already have a ton of money. I think they raised like $200 to $300 million. And they invested most of that into the Mitsubishi factory that they acquired. I think they acquired for like for penny on a dollar, like a few tens of millions, I think. But they invested like $100 million in it to be able to bring those vehicles to production. So, like, they're gonna unveil the pickup trucks and I think also the SUV next week. And they're gonna do that. They're gonna start taking reservation and everything. But they're gonna start taking reservation for like production as soon as next year, I think, or in the year after that, at most. So. I think that's going to put the most pressure on the industry, really, more than anything we've seen from pickup trucks so far, and probably the most thing that we're going to see until Tesla itself unveiled their own pickup trucks.
Actually, now may be a good time to tell everybody we're going to be at the LA Auto Show. We're mm-hmm. going to be at the Rivian event. We're going to be at the Audi event, probably, and a bunch of other stuff. LA is typically a great place for electric vehicles, so. We'll be all over the place, and that's next week.
Nissan maybe have something too. I know they have a product unveiling, but I don't think they confirm yet that it's going to be electric. But there's rumors it's going to be electric, so we might see. You know, we're going to see at least three new electric vehicles, brand new ones, maybe four or five. We'll see. And three is already good for our show. Like three company new ones
for one event.
Yeah. Because often, and we're talking about completely new, so a lot of times they're saying, "Oh, it's the North American debut, or it's not like the auto show debut," but they already unveiled the thing. So we're talking about at least three completely new ones. Of course, we're talking about the Rivian one, two Rivian one, and the Audi e-tron GT.
GT should be good.
Yeah, and then maybe the Nissan, and maybe a few others. What's next? Oh, big update on the supercharger network from Elon Musk. He said he's going to double the coverage of the network by the end of next year. And he said that Supercharger V3 is coming out early next year with, and I quote, it's going to charge much faster, he says. So
two things there.
Yeah. First, V3 is delayed, we can say, because it was supposed to come out this summer, then it was delayed to end of the year, and now it's early next year. That's a delay for sure. Yeah. Then the other thing is, double the network. Sure, that's cool. But how many times you said that before?
Yeah, I guess it started from zero, so it's been doubling like Moore's law. Like, I mean, you know, I just drove from Providence, Rhode Island to near Manchester, Vermont. And last time we did that, there was like one charger along the way, and we had to drive slow to make it. This time there was like, we could have gone two different ways. There was plenty of chargers along the way. It's, you know, the supercharger network in the U.S. is amazing, especially when you look at like Electrify America is coming out, and there's like, you know, four per state, whereas Tesla's already got like, you know, 100 per state, and well, not 100, but, you know, quite a few, and then plans to build a lot more. So Tesla's going to double their network at some, you know, in a year. That means that existing stations will go from 8 to 16 to 24, and a bunch of new stations will open. I think, you know, Tesla's so far out ahead of the rest of the other car companies. It's not even, I mean, it's 5 years at least ahead of Electrify America, in my opinion. But, you know, I don't see anybody else catching up in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, well, we discussed that last week. Yeah. I personally think Electrify America is more like 2 years behind Tesla right now, because the just at the investment rate that they're doing, they could catch up, I think. But right now, there's no doubt, you're right, that there's nothing coming close to Tesla at this point right now. But I'm not just looking at like how fast they are deploying the station right now, Electrify America. I'm also looking like at their investment rate. How fast they could catch Tesla. And when you drop like $2 billion and you look at what Tesla spent to get there, I mean, that's come close. But how the supercharger grew with like Elon's ambitious goal. And the goal I've proven to be like too ambitious at times. I mean, Tesla was talking about 18,000 supercharger around the world by the end of last year. And right now they are at 11,400. So they're definitely behind, and Elon says now double that by the end of next year, so that could be like over 20,000 stations next year. And I don't see that happening, but at the same time, like, those goals are what, like, or why Tesla always go fast too. Like, sometimes they reach too far, but even if they miss a deployment, it's, you know, that it's still going to be a pretty good deployment of charging station out there. Another article based on Elon's tweet. He was he had some pretty interesting tweets this week, Elon.
Should we talk about V3 at all?
Oh yeah, about the charge rates. You have some speculation about the charge rate.
Yeah, so I mean, we've heard that the Model 3 can already go higher than the 120 kilowatts that are at most charging stations, and I think. I can't remember exactly. I've seen a couple of different specs, like 175 up to 200 kilowatts, which would almost double the current rate. What do you think? I mean, what is V3 going to be?
Yeah, well, so that's the thing. When you talk about with V3, you're really talking about two things. You're talking about what's going to be the max charge rates of the stations, and you're talking about what kind of charge rate this less vehicle now and when the V2 is going to be deployed are going to be able to take, because that's a big thing. So right now people are all talking about 350 kilowatts. So that's the new ultra fast station that people have been deploying. People like Electrify America, like Ionity up north, up in Europe, I mean. And so far, like that 350 is more about being future proof. The only car, upcoming car, that's going to be able to take it apparently is going to be the Porsche Taycan at 352. Now, so if we were talking about V3, I think V3 is going to be something similar in terms of being a future-proof station. So now, how future-proof it's going to be. Recently, we heard this year, Elon Musk has sort of been poo-pooing a little bit the 350 kilowatts, which didn't make sense at all, because when he first announced V3 was in a tweet to me 2 years ago. And the whole thing why the tweet was interesting is because I mentioned the 350 kilowatt capacity that Porsche was coming up with, and he called that child's play, a child's toys, right? Something like that.
Child's toy, yeah.
So he implied that V3 is going to be much faster than that. Then a year and a half later, he said, oh, 350 is maybe too fast for cars.
On an earnings call with Galileo Russell.
Yeah, well, I think JB mentioned it too. Like, him and JB started talking about it, and they said something about 250 would make more sense.
Right. So, and we actually saw the Porsche Taycan charging at 250 kilowatt in a video they posted.
Yeah. So, doesn't mean that's going to be the cap. It was just like, it's what they are achieving right now. We don't know exactly, but I mean, I wouldn't be mad at 252. I think. So far I've never been on a supercharger and I said, oh, it's taking too long. I want to go home there. Like, normally I am able to match my supercharger stay with, like going to heat or something. So it's never like that big of a deal, but I know it can happen for sure. If you're doing like longer trips, there's probably going to be one or two times that you're just charging for a charge. You're just stopping to charge and that's it. So, but in that case, like 250 kilowatts, you won't be there more than like half an hour max.
Yeah, it's basically double now.
Yeah. So, and most of the time, I'm 30 minutes max, but most of the time it's going to be like 10, 15 minutes too, really depending on your state of charge. So I'll be okay with that. So, but now we're just talking about the max charge rate of the supercharger. If you're talking about the car, what the car can take now, it looks quite clear that the latest generation of the Model S and X are really capped at 120, because the existing station apparently could be up to 145, and Tesla hasn't unleashed the difference. So it looks like Model S and S are definitely capped. As for Model 3, Model 3 might be Tesla might be restricting the Model 3 a little bit. From what we're seeing in terms of capacity, it looks like the Model 3 could be up to 150, 170 maybe. So, and Tesla would be like limiting it for whatever reason, whether it be like for the differentiation with the Model S and X, which are more expensive vehicle. We don't know.
Yeah, it's also interesting to note that, you know, when a car charges now, and that's Tesla or any other electric vehicle, the charge rate starts very fast and then comes down.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the Porsche and the Model 3 can go double, like 250, they're going to come down at a much faster rate. So they're still going to be at, you know, at 50%, you're going to have 100 kilowatt. So the only real fast charging is going to be from close to empty to halfway full.
Yeah.
And the rest is going to continue to be, you know, the same curve that we already know, unless there's a battery breakthrough, which I don't think we've heard anything about.
Yeah. So what that means basically is that as long as you have charging at destination, you're going to want to not charge it for full at a supercharger and just maintain the highest rate that you can for the longest you can. And then if you can make the rest of your journey on that charge, you go for it and you charge at destination, because you're going to save a lot of time with that. But it's really like... it's a big question right now. So early next year, new supercharger comes out, probably 250 kilowatts and up capacity. Model 3 should be able to take some of it. And then does it mean there is a battery upgrade coming up from Model S and X at the same time that's going to be able to take a higher charge rate? It wouldn't make sense otherwise. Tesla's lineup is going to look very weird for a while. So yeah, I think we're going to see a timing. Probably around March too. So March could be a big event. Like, could be Model Y, pickup truck. It could be Model S and X upgrade. And then just a few months later, we've been talking about the interior refresh. So it could be a design refresh, not just a performance upgrade coming soon. So who knows? Yeah, the other thing I was going to talk about was the Tesla Mercedes-Benz Splinter Van, maybe electric Splinter Van. So Elon was talking about the mobile Tesla service guys, who some of them are using gas-powered vans. So a few people were complaining like, "Yeah, that should be Tesla vans. That should be electric vans." Elon said, "Yeah, sure, we should make that at some point." Then he followed up about maybe interesting to work with Daimler and Mercedes on an electric Sprinter van. He said that's a great van, and he said he's going to inquire about it. So, implying that he's going to reach out to Daimler about some sort of cooperation on this. And we reported just a few weeks before that Dieter Zetsche, the CEO of Daimler, I think he's the outgoing CEO, though. I think he's leaving soon.
Yeah,
he said recently that the Mercedes-Benz was open to working with Tesla again. So if you guys remember the older, longer time fans of Tesla, remember that at some point Tesla had a partnership with Daimler, both financially, where Daimler was a stakeholder in the company, but also a client from Tesla because they were buying electric powertrains from Tesla for the Smart Electric program and the B-Class electric program. Now, with those comments from the CEO of Daimler, comments from Elon Musk, an electric Sprinter van from Tesla, the van from Daimler and the powertrain from Tesla would be pretty cool. But we also noted that Daimler are already making an electric Sprinter van. So it would be weird.
One small detail.
Yeah. So it would be weird to like just, let's stop the program right now and just buy the powertrain from Tesla instead. Though the spec are not like that impressive, they don't look that impressive. So it could certainly use a more powerful powertrain. But I think that if they're going to use a more powerful, they might as well just use like the one from the EQC or something, and it would make more sense for them, I think. But if they have the capacity to make the chassis for the Sprinter van in more volume, and they could possibly just sell them to Tesla, and then Tesla could make the van themselves. But at the same time, now Tesla has been making their own service vehicle with Model S and X, like just retrofitting them with a bunch of tools and everything. So I don't know. It was weird for Elon Musk to go on this tangent there. But at the same time, it sounds cool to have like a strong commercial van that's all electric with a decent powertrain. There's certainly tons of use for it. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it sounds like more Tesla wants to get a bunch of shells from Daimler rather than kind of do a joint venture.
Yeah, I think that's the most likely outcome too. If anything comes out of this, now let's talk about China a little bit here because I think China is the place to be right now for electrification. They're doing a ton of electric interesting thing. First, we're going to talk a little bit about Tesla in China, since we're still on the topic of Tesla. They announced this week, they said that they're going to slash the prices on the Model S, X, and 3 in China because they increased the price recently due to the trade war and then the new tariffs that have come out of the trade war between China and the U.S. Tariff, when they were going from 25%, it went down to 15%. Tesla slashed the prices in the country. And then now when the trade war escalated, the tariffs went up to 40%. So not only like 25% over the tariff that they were going to have at 15, but even like 15% higher than the tariff that they were already enduring for the past few years. So big, big, big difference. And when that happened, Tesla increased the prices on Model S and X. And last week or two ago, they announced the pricing for the Model 3 in China. And they had to adjust that too, apparently, because it didn't work out. So 12 to 26% reduction in prices for all those vehicles. Tesla says that they are absorbing the difference here. Meaning that it's not like they found a way to get around the pricing, around the tariffs or anything. It's just that they're saying that they are taking the hit on their gross margin here, most likely because they've seen a big drop in demand in the country due to the higher price, and they don't want to lose their market share. So they are biting the bullet, really. So the what it means really is that the Shanghai factory, the Gigafactory 3, is just cannot come any sooner faster than that, because they needed to get around those tariffs as soon as possible. But if you don't want a Tesla in China, you don't have a lack of choices really, because every other automaker are launching all new electric vehicle first there because of their strong ZEV mandate that's starting 10% as soon as next year. So like, if you're selling gas powered car in China, you need to have electric vehicle in your lineup as soon as possible. This week, Honda got on board. So if you want an electric Honda in the US or anywhere else on earth, I think the Honda Fit EV is gone now. Like, it was like a small compliance car. I'm not even sure it's available anywhere.
Clarity. Yeah.
The Fit EV before that.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's the Clarity.
88 miles.
Yeah, 80 miles. And it's just not a fun car at all. Yeah. But and they're
looks
getting
like garbage.
Yeah. They're getting a new one in China, starting in China, the Evirus VE1. And it started at the equivalent of $25,000 US with the incentive. So
it looks like they actually want to sell these.
It looks like they want to sell these. And it looks cool, too. It looks like a lot of people said it's based on the HRV, is it? What was it called? Yeah, the HRV, the subcompact.
Oh.
CRV is the bigger one, I think, right?
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with Honda's lineup, or they might be called different in different market, but I think in most market, like the crossover subcompact is the HRV. Most people know it as the HRV. A good looking car, a bit different for the electric version, but still like decent looking. 53.6 kilowatt hour battery pack. They're claiming like 200 miles of range. They say it's NEDC, though. I have to say, like, 200 miles of range on a 53.6, it's not that ambitious. It looks a little bit ambitious, but not that much. Like, you're gonna get at least over 180, I think, with that. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a boxy car. I mean, not boxy, but it's kind of like it rides high. It's got some big wheels. Maybe that's some of the inefficiency. Also, we saw the Jaguar I-Pace didn't do so great on the mileage, comparatively to the size of the battery pack. So, it's not just like you can't throw a battery and a motor in a car and expect mm-hmm. great results. There's a lot of tuning going on.
Yeah.
And Tesla and also Hyundai are doing really well with the miles they get out of each kilowatt hour. So mm-hmm. I think some of the other automakers are realizing that you can't just throw some stuff in together and have an electric vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah, I would compare it more like to a Bolt in terms of sizes, really. But the Bolt probably, like you said, like this one is a little bit higher, I think. But the Bolt has a 60 kilowatt hour battery pack and you easily get 200 miles. So I don't know, this one like with 10% lower energy capacity. I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah, but the wheels on the Bolt are very super efficient.
Very small. Yeah, so. They're thin too. Like, yeah, that's a good point. We're still in China right now. We're talking about the solid-state battery production. So we've been talking about solid-states for a year. It's the next big thing. It's going to replace the current Li-ion cells with the liquid electrolyte with the whole solid-state battery. People are saying it's safer. People are saying that there's more energy density capacity. There's potential for more energy density. But there's still plenty of issues so far. Some issue with life cycles. They deteriorate faster now. Some issue with just bringing up to production, to volume production at a decent price that makes sense where it can actually go into commercial products. But this company in China, Qingtao Energy Development, a startup that's on a sort of spun out of... Tsinghua University. I cannot pronounce it, but I know it's like a big university. It's like one of the top, like the equivalent of the Ivy School in China. It's one of the top technical university there. I hear about it all the time. It's just the name is hard to pronounce for a Frenchman. But like a lot of battery startup in the US, they often spun out of a technical university. That's what they did here. And they raised a bunch of money to start a production line for their solid-state battery technology. And now it's up and running. So they said it is the first full production line for a solid-state battery in China. But it's not like volume. Well, they're calling it volume production, but we're talking about 100 megawatt hours per year of production right now, which is going to ramp up to 700 megawatt hour. So that's enough for a few thousand, if like we're talking about a 75 kilowatt hour battery pack, let's say. Well, we could go smaller than that if like there's really that much of an efficiency gain in terms of the weight. It could be like 50 kilowatt hour for a long range car. It's a few thousand cars per year, so it's not great, but it's a good start. And they are claiming some pretty impressive things in terms of energy density, 400 watt hour per kilogram, which would beat anything that's in volume production in terms of lithium ion battery cells right now. But they didn't say anything about the life cycles, like how many cycles it can do before it needs replacings, and also like the price. They're seeing that right, because if they're producing that right now, 100 megawatt hour, that costs a lot of money to produce. And they invested like $150 million in that production line alone. So they're going to see a return on investment. But they said that that first 100 megawatt hour is going to special equipment and high-end digital products. So apparently they already have some customers. But of course, the holy grail, it's making a battery that's approved by automakers for automotive production. And they said that they're talking to a number of large automotive manufacturers to use the batteries. So as soon as they, I'm cautiously optimistic about this project, but one of those large automotive manufacturers needs to approve the battery. Once they approve the battery, that means that, yeah, it's able to maintain high capacity for a decent number of cycles. And yes, the price is competitive enough with lithium-ion batteries to make sense inside a vehicle. Until then, I think we need to be careful about this kinds of announcement, right?
Yeah, and it's also going to need to be able to have the same kind of environmental constraints as we were just talking about winter batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Solid state electronics can usually handle close to freezing and pretty hot, but if they're going to be used in cars, they gotta get much below freezing, and theoretically, they're going to have a pretty high high temperature tolerance. Yeah. So there's a lot of little things like that we still have to see if they're going to be viable. Although, I think most people agree that, 10 years from now, nobody's going to be making lithium batteries. Well, it's unlikely that it's likely that solid state will be a big part of the battery mix.
Yeah, it looks like there's really a consensus there. It's weird, really. Like, yeah. Even Tesla seems to be like, they agree that it's the next thing. Most people disagree on the actual timeline for it.
Right, yeah. The timeline. And I think there's going to be a lot of like hybridization between now and then. Like maybe in 5 years, there'll be like, you'll have like 10 kilowatt hours of solid state, which will be like the initial charge and like the initial like power coming out, and then the
a bit like the transition that we've seen in the computer space, you mean? Where you have like
possibly, with SSDs and hard drives.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that could make sense. I haven't thought of that, but that's a good point. Quickly, let's talk about the production ramp up of the Hyundai Kona Electric. And we're starting to see them a little bit more in Europe, a little bit more in South Korea too. Because last time we talked about them on Europe this summer, they were just like producing about 1,000 a month. But last month, they ramped up to 4,600. About half of them stayed in Korea. Other half went overseas. We haven't seen them in the U.S. Yeah, well, apparently they have a few, but it's not like they don't have official pricing in the U.S. yet, I think. So we haven't even tried a car yet. So we don't have much to say until we actually can drive the car and test it out. But somehow it looks like a lot of people are impressed in Europe. Could be a very decent car for the price. Like the Model 3, they're starting with the long-range version, and the shorter-range version is going to come too, more affordable. But the longer-range version at the equivalent of about $40,000 is not bad. It's pretty attractive, really.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that we haven't been able to get our hands on one yet. There was an event in LA, and we didn't get invited, even though we're the largest EV site out there.
And, oh, you know,
and we, Well, there might be something in China that we don't know about. Anyway, you know, we reviewed the Ioniq. We were early reviewers. I think we did a really good job there. I did a review. Jamie did a review. There was quite a bit. So if anybody at Hyundai is listening, we'd love to review the Kona. We sat in one in at the Paris Motor Show. I'm sure we're going to see a few at the LA Motor Show. But, you know, we're not going to review it without actually getting some real behind the wheel time. And it is
a few weeks too. Like they have some press car apparently around the US, around
yeah, America, but it's a few days, I think.
Yeah. All right. For a month, at there least a go. Month in January, like, and I'm not going to have a car myself. I'm going to just get a press unit. So give me one while in Los Angeles. I'm going to get a review on it for somewhat a long-term driving. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Something a little bit less fun now.
And 4,600 a month is impressive. Like that's, we're starting to get some real numbers out.
I should address that, right? Because that was the big difference. We were told for the longest time that it's going to be only 30,000 per year capacity. So already 4,600 per month is already higher than that. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be able to maintain it. So I don't know. Don't know why there was such a big ramp from 1,000 a month to 4,600. But if they're able to maintain that, that'd be good news.
It sounds like they got themselves a good battery supplier, or they got themselves a lot more production than they had originally done. And I think that was the problem with the Ioniq. They just really only made enough, you know, to get into the compliance arena, even though it was a pretty solid car.
My only fear is that since the production was limited to 1,000 for like a few months, maybe they were still getting batteries. Because I like you said, with the Ioniq, the bottleneck was the battery cell supply. They confirmed that, I think, several times. So maybe they were still getting batteries where the production, so the maybe the bottleneck was on their side. And so they had the reserve of battery pack for a few months of being slow production on their side. And now they were able to fix that bottlenecks and make more cars. I don't know. We're going to have to track the production of the Kona Electric for the next few months and see how it goes. But if they can maintain what they're doing now, that's great. And now on a little sadder note here, oil companies are officially asking the Republicans to kill the effort to extend the electric vehicle tax credit in the U.S. So that's a real bummer, because those guys have a lot of weight with the Republicans, a lot of money going in a lot of pockets. And as you guys know, there's two different efforts right now to extend to change the tax credit in the U.S., federal tax credit for electric vehicles, one of them to kill it and one of them to extend it. Both of them have been introduced by Republicans. One of them by Republicans that had been ousted from the Senate.
Dean Heller from Nevada, which obviously is.
So now it's all about like who's going to get behind what what bill. And the oil company was clear that they want the Republicans to get behind the bill to kill the tax credit. So, I mean, are we going to see the Republicans go against the desire of the oil companies? That would be a first. But there's definitely an argument to be made for the Republicans here that makes sense to extend it, because it's going to hurt American companies more than anyone right now. Well, if you leave it as it is right now, if you kill it altogether, then there's no argument really for the American companies, because it's going to be on the same. There is still one, because it's going to slow down the overall market in the U.S. in terms of electric vehicles. So it's not going to encourage the American companies to do as many electric vehicles. And if you do that, then the whole industry, American automotive industry, gets behind the rest of the world, and the rest of the world is moving forward with EVs. So you put at risk American companies, I think, if you do it.
Yeah, but are Republicans that smart, or are they just like, hey, the oil company just gave me $100,000, I gotta vote for this thing?
That's the American.
Are they actually thinking? Like, I really don't know if they're thinking that deeply about this stuff.
I mean, if it's really like people say it is, then the money is running politics in the U.S., then yeah, that doesn't really matter, I guess, whether they would see it like that or not. They're just going to do whatever the donor says, right?
Kind of feels like that. And I would say, like, you know, right now, there's like this time between when the Democrats come in to the House, because the House is going to be kind of run by the Democrats. Mm-hmm. They want a majority there. There's this like time period between now and when they come in January that it feels like they're really pushing for some sort of kill the EB bill to happen right now. Because if it doesn't happen now, if nothing happens now, then it looks bad for Republicans going forth. Nothing's going to pass because the Democrats run the House and the, mm-hmm. the Senate. So it's just going to be stalemate all up and down. But so it's going to look bad for the Republicans.
But stalemate on an EV bill only, though, right?
Yeah, because the House won't pass, in my opinion. Well, I don't know. I mean, there's some Democrats that are kind of in the pocket of oil as well. But I don't think killing the EV bill could happen after the Democrats are in power. I mean, you would need like 30 Democrats to.
But my point is even like when we're talking about an EV tax credit specific bill, just for that, because that like you said, since the House is gonna be Democrat, then the Senate is gonna be Republican. Either one of them can just kill each other's bill. But what the oil companies mentioned directly in their letter to the Senate leaders and the House leader for the Republicans was not let it pass in a tax bill specifically. So they know that nothing's going to happen in a specific bill like they are proposing, the two different bills for the tax credit. I think they anticipate that it's going to be part, since it's a federal tax credit, it's part of the tax code. So if there's a new tax bill coming up, you could insert an amendment to the federal tax credit for EVs. So I think they're looking at that specifically, because then you're going to have to vote yes or no on the whole bill. And so it's going to be more about negotiating all the different amendments. And one of them could be about the federal tax credit bill.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that the Republicans could use that as a bargaining chip.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it is kind of scary, but I mean,
same thing happened last year, right? That was the same situation when we talked about last year.
It was kind of the reverse, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's a big mess. You know, I hate our government. It's just a mess.
Well, let's talk about, before we leave, about something a little bit more fun. You tested out a new e-bike that looks pretty cool, like cool enough that I would buy one, I think, if it was for sale directly and not another damn crowdfunding thing.
I know. I hate the crowdfunding thing because like there's 100, you know, e-bikes right now on crowdfunding, and maybe like 5 or 10 of them are going to be actual make it to the market. But this one was actually pretty good. You know, the woman who runs the company, or the co-founder of the company, was super into e-bikes. She, you know, she's from Montreal, so you should probably go check out their operations. She went to school in China, so she speaks English or speaks Chinese pretty well, and she goes to all the factories and kind of can pick and choose like which ones to run with. The bike is called Carbo. It's a super light, and I mean really light, electric bike that kind of weighs the same as a regular folding bike, but this is an electric folding bike. The battery pack is in the seat, which they say is a low center of gravity, but when I look at it, it's not really low center of gravity. But anyway, the bike feels great. It feels like you're riding a regular folding bike, and maybe even a better, like a high-end folding bike. And not just like the Brompton, because the Bromptons have kind of small wheels and you know, I don't particularly like those because they don't go that fast. This one, you know, we were riding around New York City with all the potholes and the traffic, and I was like, wow, this is just, I'm flying along 20 miles per hour or whatever, you know, no effort, just kind of pedaling. Can get anywhere in New York City really quickly. It's so light that you can fold it up and put it in your backpack. They have actually a backpack carrying case for it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know what, this is a really good bike. I really hope they end up making it. And you know, looking at their page, they're close to $1 million, you know, 10 times what they needed to start building it. They say they're going to start delivering in April, which is when the sun theoretically coming out in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're thinking about biking in spring, maybe jump on this. I think actually it's ending either today or tomorrow.
Oh.
So, yeah, you might want to jump on quick. But it's a great bike. Hopefully,
is it throttle? Yeah. Can you do throttle only on it, or is it just a pedal assist?
They have a throttle, but for the European market, you're not supposed to have a throttle, so it's not going to come with a throttle for Europe.
Okay.
In the U.S., you know, there's tons of different jurisdictions, so they will come with a throttle, which is also nice. I mean, you know, all these like little scooters that are in every city now, they're basically like e-bikes that you stand on with a throttle. Mm-hmm. And this is like kind of nice. You sit down, you can steer better. It's a little bit more stable. And but you still have that same throttle, except this one gets you up to, you know, around 20 miles per hour. And, you know, it's carbon, which like I've never had a carbon fiber bike. I've seen them. I've picked them up. They're extremely light. But I've also heard that like
they break.
You hit one. And it doesn't just break like a, you know, bent frame or whatever. So right. So that was a little scary, but, you know, I was tooling around pretty hard and it didn't seem to have any issues. You know, I think if the times I've heard of carbon fiber breaking, it's, you know, in a wreck or somebody put it on that bike holder thing too tightly or whatever. And once that happens, like the frame's useless. So, you know, one good thing about the Carbo bike is that every single piece is like, you know, you can just go out and get another piece. So theoretically, you can just go out and get in the frame. They found carbon fiber frames to be very inexpensive somehow, because, you know, usually I hear like $5,000 for a bike frame.
Yeah.
And this is like starts at $1,200 for the whole bike. So whole electric bike.
Just on the crowdsourced, that's the other thing that we said we don't like crowdsourcing, but my other thing, like, is the pricing is going to be like much more expensive, right, than what is right now on the crowdsource. What is it, Indiegogo or Kickstarter or whatever?
Yeah. So I think the prices when they come out are going to be, you know, like $2,000, whereas you can get it right now for $1,200 on crowdsource. So, I mean, you're taking a risk, like maybe something happens where it doesn't come to market and you don't get your money back. But, you know, I would say like you got a 90% chance, give or take, of the bike coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And you're paying, you know, close to half the price. So it's not a bad bet. And, you know, talking to from Carbo, they're extremely dedicated. She's very passionate about the biking products. She's very knowledgeable. I don't see them as the type that would just take money and run. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm obviously not going to guarantee it. The good news is we're going to have a final production unit in April, and we're going to do a deep review of it. So
cool.
Yeah,
I think that's great potential to be like sort of a great last few miles vehicle, really, like, because it's something that you can take on a train, take on a bus, and if you're still a public transportation user, but you get some like a big walking commute too, might be a great solution for people. So that's pretty much the show for this week, guys. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks a lot to our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/electric. Thanks a lot for everyone that's subscribing on YouTube and subscribing on your podcast app. We appreciate it, and we're going to see you next time, same time next week, and we're going to talk about everything that we saw at the Los Angeles Auto Show. And if you're out there and you see us, give us a shout out, and we'll see.